Hello, and welcome to Careful Thinking, a new podcast exploring ideas about care. I'm Martin Robb, and I'm the host of the podcast. Careful Thinking is inspired by a belief that thinking critically about care can both deepen our understanding and help to improve the everyday practice and experience of care. In each episode of the podcast, you'll hear an in-depth conversation with a writer, researcher, or practitioner at the cutting edge of current thinking about care. My guest for this episode is Erica Borgstrom. Erica is a colleague of mine in the School of Health, Wellbeing and Social Care at the Open University here in the UK. Erica is a professor of medical anthropology at the Open University, where she leads Open Thanatology, the university's interdisciplinary research group for the study of death, dying, loss and grief across the life course. Erica is also editor of the International Interdisciplinary Journal Mortality, and one of the editors overseeing the book series Death and Culture for Bristol University Press. Her doctoral research at the University of Cambridge ethnographically examined English end-of-life care from policy to practice to everyday experiences, focusing on choice and advanced care planning. With Simon Cohn and Annalika Dreesen, Erica worked on the Forms of Care project, which sought to critically understand what not intervening looks like and how we can appreciate such non-actions as care. With a range of collaborators across a number of projects, Erica has also looked at how palliative and end-of-life care are provided in various contexts, including in acute hospital settings, in hospices, and through doula provision. Recently, one of Erica's main research projects has been focused on understanding how people interpret and use the ambitions framework for palliative and end-of-life care, a project funded by NHS England and Marie Curie. Erica is the author or co-author of many articles and book chapters. She's co-edited two collections on research methodology, Researching Death, Dying and Bereavement, and Unpacking Sensitive Research. And with Sharon Mallon, she co-edited the collection Narratives of COVID, Loss, Dying, Death and Grief During COVID-19. So Erica and I have been colleagues for a number of years now, but we've never actually worked together directly. So although I've been aware in a very general sense of Erica's important work in the field of end-of-life care, until now I've never really had a proper chance to talk to her about it. So I'm really glad of this opportunity to explore Erica's work with her in some detail. So Erica, thank you for agreeing to be a guest on the podcast and a very warm welcome to Careful Thinking.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Martin.
So just a question to kick us off then. Can you tell us how you, as someone originally trained in anthropology, came to be researching end-of-life care? How did your interest in this whole area come about?
Yeah, so when I was doing my undergraduate in anthropology, I actually did what was called the four fields of anthropology, where we look at social, cultural, we did biological, learned loads about primates, aspects about medical and things also around material cultural. And I was really intrigued by issues around health and illness and how that intersected with some of the social and cultural ways in which people understood their daily lives. And as I progressed through my studies, I was particularly interested in topics that I discovered over time were actually on that cusp of life and death. And the reason I became interested in those is because I thought they gave us quite a good insight into what people valued in terms of what mattered to them in their day-to-day activities, what mattered to them in their wider understandings and worldviews and their belief systems, but also in terms of the activities and practices that people did at those times and how that expressed or didn't what was mattering to them and what might be done. So my master's looked at issues of infanticide in parts of Africa. And then when it came to sort of post-master's, I took up a research assistant post, which was about palliative care, which then opened up my eyes to palliative and end-of-life care as being one of those fields where I could explore those issues of values and what matters to people in different ways. And I've not looked back since.
Absolutely. So listeners will have picked up maybe from your accent that although you're based here in the UK, you're not originally from here. And I know that you have an interesting multinational background. So could you tell us something about your roots and whether you think those diverse identities have given you a particular perspective on your chosen research area?
Yeah. So despite living in the country for nearly 20 years, I still get asked at least weekly where I'm really from. And usually I turn that back onto people to try to guess from my accent, and I'll get a variety of responses. And that's okay, because actually my accent will change. But I'm originally from the United States of America, where we moved around a lot when I was a child. And then I've also lived in Germany for a significant period of my life growing up as a teenager, where I had the lucky fortune of going to an international school and being exposed to lots and lots of different people and their cultures. And my partner is German, and I met him when I was in Germany, and his family also come from different countries as well. And it's always struck me, even growing up when I was in the States, that we had a multicultural heritage. So my surname Borgström is actually Swedish. My family also has German heritage over times. And we grew up with this multi-layering of different practices and belief systems and ways of communicating and being in the world. And I always took that for granted. And then when I moved, particularly to England, and was studying anthropology, I realized that wasn't necessarily so. And so one of the things that drew me more and more into my anthropology studies is that what anthropologists sometimes say of taking the granted and the common sense and flipping it on its head. And so I think my exposure in my life as I grew up really set me well for being an anthropologist in that sense, in terms of I was exposed to lots of different things. I could ask questions about that. Anything that felt universal or a norm, I quickly, you know, knew wasn't necessarily the case. And I could ask questions in a way that would help me unpick that a bit more. And it's something that I find when I do my research on palliative and end-of-life care, it comes up a lot, because how we do palliative and end-of-life care varies a lot in the different countries that I might consider home at any one period, whether that be the UK, Germany, or the US. Even when English is the common language in some of those things, actually what is meant by those terms is very different. And some of the core concepts that I've used in my research don't translate into German, which is always a great challenge when trying to speak to in-laws about my research and why it matters. And so it's been a really useful tool to have in my research career in terms of opening up different ways of viewing the world.
Interesting. And do you think attitudes to death and dying, have you found that they vary in the different cultures with which you're familiar, or the different national contexts with it, which you're familiar?
Yeah, most definitely. The attitudes vary, the different expectations about maybe what should happen towards the end of life, and particularly in terms of the extent of medical intervention and patient choice around different aspects. Also, different attitudes around post-death practices and how quickly certain activities should happen and how one should and shouldn't speak about things. I remember very vividly in my doctoral research when I started to realize actually how long it can take in the UK between a death and the actual internment of a body. Whereas where I grew up in the States, and this isn't necessarily common practice throughout all of the US, it would be within 3 days. Whereas here in the UK, it could be much more like 2 to 3 weeks. And also where I grew up in the States, it was common to have open caskets and be very aware of you know, what the dead person looks like. And here, not necessarily so. And in Germany, also not so. And in Germany, you might be restricted also to very specific days of the week based on local policies. So yeah, there are definitely different attitudes and practices that exist. And it's interesting having to navigate them as a family, I would say, as well.
So you mentioned your PhD thesis at Cambridge University, and you submitted that in 2013, and it was entitled Planning for Death, an Ethnographic Study of Choice and English End-of-Life Care. Can you tell us something about that research? What the aims of the research were and what the research actually involved?
Yeah, so my PhD was funded by a National Institute for Health Research, CLARC, so Collaboration for Leadership and Applied Health Research and Care, that Cambridge was part of at the time. And one of the stipulations of that funding was I could take whatever angle I would like, so long as it was about end-of-life care. So I could be an anthropologist in this applied health setting, but it had to be looking at end-of-life care. And so what I set out as an anthropologist to do was try to figure out a little bit more about what was meant by end-of-life care in that setting. And I started my PhD in 2010. And 2 years prior to that, England had released the first national strategy for end-of-life care. And in that document, the concept of a choice, patient choice, patient preference, and advanced care planning were really prominent. And so I decided to do my PhD on that concept of choice and try to figure out what choice meant in the context of end-of-life care and follow that ethnographically. So figuring out how does choice come about in sort of policy circles, rhetoric, how are they trying to implement this national strategy? What are healthcare practitioners doing in the context of choice, and particularly around the practice of advanced care planning, which was linked very strongly in the policy documents as a mechanism for capturing patient choice? And then I spent a lot of time with people who were supposed to be in their last year of life based on their different prognoses to see how and if and when choice comes up in their daily life, and particularly thinking in the context of the end of life, with care kind of being bracketed in that. So also, where does care come in and out of the equation? And it was quite a fascinating study in terms of juxtapositioning that policy and practice and everyday lived experience, which doesn't often necessarily get done in applied health research. And it was also quite fascinating in terms of unpicking, particularly for policymakers, the values they hold around choice and how that can rub up against people's everyday expectations and experiences around how they live their lives, and particularly around the tension around individual autonomy and what that might look like going forward for doing end-of-life care.
Yeah, and you obviously want to problematize the notion of choice. Can you just say a bit more about why you thought the whole notion of choice was problematic?
Yeah, so thanks for that question, because it is something that can be a bit tricky for people to understand. Like, why would you want to problematize choice, particularly patient choice, in a country that values patient autonomy in healthcare and generally neoliberal notions around the individual being to exercise, you know, their own autonomy and that they have agency? So one of my issues with choice in the context of palliative and end-of-life care, particularly at the time I was doing my research then, was they're actually very clear when you unpick some of the discourses, limits to choice in the context of end-of-life care. It wasn't that someone can have a choice about anything. People couldn't necessarily choose to have interventions. They could choose to decline something. There was also no choice around assisted dying. And the way choice was being mobilized as an idea was very specifically around advanced care planning. For those unfamiliar with advanced care planning, that essentially is the idea that someone thinks about their future care, what they might prefer to happen, and to document those preferences and communicate them, ideally with those that live with them or those around them and who support them, and also their healthcare professionals. Now, at the time of my research, a lot of advanced care planning focused specifically on place of death, so where someone might want to die, with a lot of heavy policy rhetoric saying that people want to die at home, and then some stuff around declining certain treatments. And so my problematization with choice there is, on one hand, it sounds in a way very noble in that we're giving people, you know, what they want towards the end of life, but actually it was quite constrained choice. And when I spent time with people who were, you know, supposedly tasked with having to make advanced care plans, a lot of them didn't want to do it in that way. The plans aided healthcare professionals in knowing how to operationalize certain aspects of care, but they didn't necessarily always help the people in their day-to-day life as they were living towards the end of the life. They maybe had other things they wanted to prioritize. And that's quite tricky in a healthcare system that's trying to say, let's do these plans, and people want to be doing something else instead.
Now, as well as choice, you also emphasize relationality in your thesis, and it's a subject you return to in a paper you published in 2019 with Julie Ellis and Kate Woodthorpe, which had the eye-catching title, "We Don't Want to Go and Be Idle Ducks, Family Practices at the End of Life," in which you argue that the end of life is a relational experience in which everyday family practices are embedded and enacted. And you focus in the paper on family practices. And I think you want to promote the idea that death and dying is something that families do together. But how exactly do families do that? And why is it important to consider family relationships in thinking about palliative care?
Wow, Fab, thank you for thinking about that paper. So Julie and Kate are both good friends of mine, or academic friends that we've become over the years, with a shared interest in the topics that we have. They're both sociologists. And it's Julie's thanks for bringing up Morgan's idea of family practices to helping me think about some of my work. And the quote in the title, "We Don't Want to Go and Be Idle Ducks," comes from some of my ethnographic fieldwork. And that's what a couple had said when thinking about, you know, do they go somewhere or not to go see their children, adult children, and what that then means in terms of dependency and revealing certain aspects of their day-to-day lives and how their declining health was impacting their functioning. Julie, Kate, and I are quite intrigued about the relationality aspects of end-of-life care and family practices in that, from our social science backgrounds, we know no man is an island, to use that sort of cliche quote, and that actually people are constantly making decisions and doing stuff in relation to other people. And this is particularly useful when thinking about within the home. So we often think about family environments within home spaces, but also family that's distributed. And we don't use a normative notion of family. It can be however defined, but we're particularly intrigued by what are the things that people do that help them maintain a sense of being connected as family in the context of end of life, and particularly how they are trying to do things, and whether that's making decisions or have certain meals together or prepare different, you know, I think Julie has a wonderful example around using a costume being designed for a child's performance, doing things that reassert their sociality with one another and that interconnectedness, and don't always just focus on the more classic notion sometimes of dependency and the sort of the reciprocal nature of that. Julie's particularly intrigued by aspects of food. And I was particularly intrigued because of my ethnographic focus on choice around how people made certain decisions that did or did not allow them to focus on the family. And I was particularly interested in the practices that allowed people to acknowledge and stake claims to their relationships as they continue towards the end of life. And that was particularly important because there's also a lot of emphasis in some of the literature around social isolation as people are dying, and also a lot of emphasis within healthcare practices about focusing just on the individual, like I said earlier, around that choice, and maybe sometimes the individual and their carer. But actually, the family practices were much wider than that. And so our attempt to sort of highlight that is there's a much wider range of people that are being involved. And it's actually something Julie and I are writing more about this year.
So one of the key strands in your work has been analyzing and critiquing public policy around end-of-life care. And in a paper you published in 2015 with Tony Walter on choice and compassion at the end of life, you critically analyze English policy discourse at the time. And you both return to the critique of the idea of choice from your earlier work, arguing interestingly that what people are not given is a choice not to choose, and that choice can sometimes be a burden, which is, I found interesting. But you also critique in that paper what you call the compassionate care discourse. And I found it interesting that you drew on the writings of feminist care ethicists like Annelies van Heist, Nell Noddings, Joan Tronto, names that will be familiar to listeners from earlier episodes of the podcast. So what exactly is your critique of the compassionate care discourse?
Yeah, thank you. So this is one of those early pieces that sort of were inspired by some of my PhD research, and Tony Walter very kindly, after hearing me speak at a conference, reached out for us to collaborate on this paper. So that was a great opportunity early in my career. A lot of the things that inspired that paper for both Tony and I were partly my research and the policy critiques I've done, and I continue to do that in my work as a sort of a friendly critic for the policymakers, because I don't envy their job in any way in terms of what they're having to do. But also at the time, there were several quote unquote scandals happening in the UK around care, both specifically about end of life care, but generally about healthcare and different, particularly hospital and care home settings. And actually that concept of scandals coming around, that is again something that happens every so many years in the UK. And what we found at the time is there were sort of two main rhetorics that were getting a lot of spotlight in the end-of-life care policy field in response to those scandals. So one was, again, emphasizing choice, and that, you know, if we give patients these choice, if we do what they want, we're going to have good care. That was sort of a logic of the policy that was happening at the time. And another bit of discourse that was happening a lot at the time was this notion of compassionate care. And it was actually something that came out of several of the reports in terms of these scandals, in that, you know, if healthcare settings could be reorienting their culture to be more compassionate and have compassionate care, that these scandals wouldn't happen. And Tony's and I critique on this was that actually that rhetoric and discourse around compassionate care was really focusing on the value that people attach to the notion of compassion as a good thing, rather than actually interrogating how care is sometimes really undervalued in the system and how what people actually find compassionate in terms of care, such as spending time with someone, is financially undervalued in the care system as well. And so we were kind of pointing out, it's nice to say these things, but unless you really have a shift in terms of the structures, trying to emphasize compassionate care in a healthcare system without making huge changes underlying how, you know, healthcare is delivered and thought about isn't necessarily going to meet that compassionate care. And in there also, there's a bit of a hint in terms of the discourse was focusing a lot on, again, a more patient-oriented model, just like the choice one was, rather than thinking about also how compassion is relational and also requires looking after the people who are providing that care and how we think about them and care for them and not just see them as mechanisms for care delivery. So that's how we tried to work on that one. But it's definitely one I think that probably needs revisiting because it's, again, the compassion in the context of end-of-life care comes up in different contexts and with slightly different meanings over the past decade.
Now, you mentioned scandals, which is a nice link to my next question. I wanted to turn to a specific policy around end-of-life care and to the work you did in 2022, or you published in 22 with Natasha Lemos-Decker, which was your ethnographic analysis of the Liverpool care pathway as it was put into practice in England and the Netherlands. So maybe for those who are not familiar with it, you could just start by describing what the Liverpool care pathway is or was, and what was the scandal that led to its eventual abandonment as a policy?
Yeah. So the Liverpool Care Pathway, or sometimes abbreviated to the LCP, in very simple terms, on one hand, is actually a document that sets out how care can be organized and delivered in what is expected to be a person's last 3 days of life. Now, it might be slightly longer, it might be slightly shorter, because actually trying to prognosticate someone's end of life is actually really, really tricky clinically. But what that document was trying to do was capture what was thought of as very good or best practice in hospices, which are world renowned, particularly British hospices, for their end of life care, and trying to translate that into other clinical settings through the use of this document. So it would have things around encouraging certain types of conversations, both with the patient where possible and or those close to them. It was around thinking about what interventions, medical interventions might have been happening and which ones might be suitable to withdraw. So again, using the clinical expertise at the time, whether about fluids and hydration were useful and sort of recommending the withdrawal of that, and particularly IV fluids in terms of reducing certain types of medication that might be life prolonging and perhaps no longer needed in these last few days of life. And also in terms of thinking about some of that routine monitoring, particularly for hospital settings, and whether or not all of that was always necessary. And the notion was that this was supposed to guide people to provide what was thought of as high quality end of life care in different care settings, regardless if they'd been trained, especially in palliative and end of life care. It was one of the three practice shifts that were supported in that national strategy for end of life care that was released in 2008. And so it had huge policy backing in England, and tied to that, hospitals had sort of financial support to roll it out. And over time, there was some questions around the evidence base for the LCP in terms of, you know, what research had been done to help deliver it, to develop it and to deliver it. How well was it being supported in its rollout? And in particularly, there was some public concern that was featuring in some British tabloids around people being put on the LCP pathway and essentially told they're on the death pathway, that they're going to die. And this was particularly concerning for families who thought that the person that they loved and cared about wasn't dying. And so there was a lot of concern about whether it was being misused to shorten people's lives, potentially in the worst case scenario. And that led to some investigation about whether it should be used or not. And actually in the UK, the response was, there's too much public distrust on this pathway. We'll just stop it from practice. And instead, every care setting now has to come up with their own way of how we do end-of-life care and how we support it, whether there's documents or not. And so that was a huge culture shift after spending years of trying to roll out a certain. But during that time, as we were having our own national rollout, and even during that scandal, the LCP was being rolled out in other countries. And one of the main countries that has adopted it is the Netherlands. And particularly they were intrigued to use it in care home settings where many people will live their last years of life and therefore also maybe their last days of life. And care home staff will not necessarily have the same level of nursing and clinical care training, but the LCP was viewed as a way of enabling them to have clinical input and guidance towards managing someone's last few days of life. And so the role of implementing it in the Netherlands involved some translation to make it make sense there, but didn't necessarily require lots of shifting in terms of how it looks or how it was used. And Natasha and I, so Natasha's based in the Netherlands and I've been doing my work in the UK, met at a conference many years ago and got to just sort of talking about the LCP and how it kind of came up in our different ethnographic studies. So it came up when I was researching issues of choice and palliative and end-of-life care more generally as I was doing my various different projects. And Natasha had been doing research in care homes and had seen, you know, this document came up. So we set out to do some secondary analysis of our individual ethnographic work and compare that to see what we could see in terms of how the LCP was being used and made sense of in those different settings and perhaps shine a different light onto the notion of it failing in the UK that didn't necessarily just think about how the public discourse was or the public response to it was, but actually in terms of the logics behind the rollout and trying to take what is care practice in one setting and implement it in another.
So what conclusions did you come to as a result of your secondary analysis?
Yeah, it's a great question. So some of it was we really attended to how the LCP as a document and as a policy rollout was trying to standardize elements of palliative and end-of-life care. And in that assumed people had the same values and professional orientations towards palliative and end-of-life care. But in our different ethnographic studies, we'd seen that's not necessarily how people operate in the day-to-day world, which as social scientists, it kind of feels like, of course not, but it's quite useful. But also how it was trying to standardize values around the end of life that aren't necessarily shared without, you know, really understanding different people's perspectives. And that is partly why we had the issues here in the UK. But the Netherlands has kept the Liverpool care pathway in the settings that have adopted it, even though they know what's happened here, because they use it in a slightly different way. And so there's also something really interesting about how the same document or slightly modified document gets repurposed in different ways to fit the setting it's in.
Thank you. That was really interesting. Interesting about the differences between the two countries as well. So I mentioned in my introduction the Forms of Care project. You had funding from the Economic and Social Research Council in 2018, and you worked with your colleagues Simon Cohen and Annalieke Driessen on that. So could you tell us something about that study and what were the questions driving it?
Yeah, so the inspiration for that study came from a workshop I went to many years ago where I was talking to one of the other participants. And the workshop was focusing on No Decision Without Me. It was a very choice end-of-life care oriented workshop. And it was a mixture of healthcare practitioners. I was, I think, the only academic in the room, and then patient and public involvement advisors that were in there. And I was talking to one of those patient and public advisors who was telling me about if someone has something like a pacemaker, that actually that is as an intervention in there to always try to restart the heart to keep them living longer and longer and longer. And actually, if they're identified as being in the last phases of life and likely to dying, that actually that pacemaker should be shut off because otherwise it's going to keep trying to shock them back to life even as they're quote unquote naturally dying. And that really intrigued me as this notion of like, oh, when do we have to like not intervene or do like the undoing of an intervention in order to be caring, particularly in the context of the end of life? So Simon and I played with that idea, wrote the grant application, very pleased the ESRC took it and said yes. And then we brought Annalieke on board, who did lots of our field work, although the three of us all did field work, but she did the bulk of the ethnographic work. And for us, it was just trying to understand really like what does not intervening mean and look like? What possibly might be the languages we have for it. It's really clumsy. There's a lot of conversations in palliative care around withholding and withdrawing that have lots of negative connotations for patients and those around them. Whereas, of course, the palliative care teams will hold a lot of care values in those conversations. So we were just trying to understand, you know, what does that look like? And particularly against a bigger backdrop of biomedicine that is pushing for intervention and particularly technological innovation and life extending attributes. And what does that then mean when life is towards its limits?
And you published some really interesting papers from that study just on those issues. For example, there was one in which you explore the concepts of patienthood and personhood in a paper entitled Human and Person When Life is Fragile, New Relationships and Inherent Ambivalences in the Care of Dying Patients. And I thought it was interesting you identified two repertoires of patienthood in that paper, the patient as human and the patient as person. I thought that was an interesting distinction. So perhaps you can expand on what you mean by that distinction.
Yeah, and this is one of those papers that I think we got to geek out a little bit with some of the theories, if that's not off. So if anyone were to go and read that paper, it can be a bit heavy in points, I guess. So for us, that distinction was one of those things that we were seeing in the different ethnographic case studies that were coming through, and particularly when we sat as a team to discuss, oh, what are some of these like niggling issues that are coming up? And so there were sort of these two repertoires around human and person, and the human focused a lot on the body and the functions and how they might extend that humanness in the world, like being able to live longer. So there's lots of things around how technology gets involved. Annalika had some interesting cases that involved people who were in intensive care and sort of how that then manifested itself. And then we had this notion of these patients as persons. And one of the things that I've always been amazed by when I research palliative and end-of-life care and spend a lot of time, particularly with palliative care practitioners, is how strongly they try to hold on to not just reducing a person, a body, to physical functioning. And so palliative care will often talk about being quite holistic and thinking about the social, the psychological, the spiritual. And so the patient as person is often attending to how the palliative care team are trying to hold on to that holism. And so we would see cases of where they might make decisions that prioritize someone spending time with other family or doing certain spiritual practices that might not be the best medical clinical advice in terms of the bodily functioning, but allowed them to exert their personhood in a different way and in a way that they valued or the people around them really valued.
I thought that was a really interesting aspect of that paper where you highlight some of the inbuilt tensions in palliative care between respecting the personhood of the patient and clinical priorities, which, as you say, increasingly are influenced by technological interventions. And there was a lovely example of the Buddhist man who wanted to go away and practice his spiritual beliefs at the end of care, which kind of threw his clinical team into panic and conflicted with their priorities. So do you think at the end of the day, these are unresolvable tensions?
Oh, that feels like a big existential question, Marge. I think in a way there's always unresolvable tensions because there's different priorities from different perspectives. And I think the hard bit for anyone operating in any of these systems is actually those different perspectives are rarely explicitly articulated. And so it only becomes a tension because the trajectory of care is not as smooth as maybe people are expecting. And sometimes there's tensions that one bit of the party understands there's a tension and another bit doesn't at all. So I think there's always going to be tensions, and attempting to resolve them all the time it would not be possible with human diversity. But I think that there's particular tensions for palliative care in that it wants to hold on to this holism of looking after this person in a very social, psychological, spiritual, as well as physical way. But it operates predominantly in a healthcare system that's going to prioritize the physical and reward activities that prioritize that more clinical nature. And so there's just that tension for those palliative care teams. And I think the tension then gets felt sometimes by the patients or those close to them in that they might have other priorities at times, or sometimes they have priorities around the clinical side that contradict the priorities of the palliative care team. So we do also see lots of examples where people want certain medical interventions and the palliative care team might advise against it because of how it's going to impact the body. But it's trying to explain that in ways that respects both perspectives or more than two perspectives can be really tricky.
So in another paper that emerged from the same study, you and your colleagues write about different ways of being with dying patients. And you focus particularly on how the COVID-19 pandemic affected that. What did you conclude about the relationship between intimacy and physical proximity?
Yeah, that was really interesting because as we were wrapping up some of the fieldwork for the Forms of Care project, COVID-19 happened. And in the UK, that included lockdowns. And we kept actually in really close contact with the palliative care teams we were working with to see how that impacted what they did and what it meant for their clinical practice, but also in terms of their own well-being. And what we found is that they were actually, as a team, really disbanded across their trusts. They were often asked to bring their expertise in terms of symptom management or end-of-life care to different parts of the hospital. They did a lot of educating roles. And one of them, and I distinctly remember this in one of our workshops, noted how it took a little while for them to really clock that the family of patients were no longer in the wards. They were just so busy doing things and how they had to reorientate themselves to doing different ways of their care, and how sometimes in quote unquote normal times, the family might be around and you might be, as a palliative care team, able to give the family certain tasks, such as being at the bedside towards the end of life. And people can find that incredibly meaningful. And so it was really intriguing for the staff to try to sort of think about, oh, how do they do that? And how they had to be those mediators of presence in different ways, and how they had to think about what does it mean in order to enable that connectedness between people when they can't be physically present? There was also a lot of conversation in some of our work with them in terms of physical touch. So in terms of how all of that protective gear may have shifted the physical touch that they usually have with patients, not just in terms of that more physical care that they do in terms of, you know, administrating certain medication or lotions, but the holding of hands that could happen. And how that might be differently. And also having to, when families were allowed on the wards, and often it was in very constricted circumstances, how to encourage them in ways to be intimate, because people felt really out of place having to be in all the PPE. And can they go closer? Could they take a hand or a glove, you know, a glove off of a hand to hold someone else's hands or not? And having to navigate that in a way where, when the teams felt they didn't really have very clear rules or social guides on how to do that well in a very caring manner. And this very exercised, I would say, the team as well, because one of the phrases that is used a lot in English palliative care is that how someone dies lives in the memory of those who live on. And so they're very concerned with creating end-of-life scenarios that aren't just supportive for the person that is dying, but also those around them.
I mean, it must have been a really difficult time for people working in palliative care, but we know it's a really difficult time for people who lost loved ones or had loved ones in care homes and hospices when they couldn't visit. So since we've mentioned the pandemic, I think this is an appropriate point to talk about the collection that you edited with our former colleague, Sharon Mallon, Narratives of COVID, Loss, Dying, Death and Grief During COVID-19. I'd be interested to know how that book came about and what kinds of narratives are included in it. And what really struck you about the experiences of the people who contributed to it?
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that book. That really came out of a time where I was recognizing in the university that we had policies that were trying to be very compassionate and caring, instead of having extra leave and encouraging people to talk to each other, but that actually there was a lot of hidden life still happening for people, not just because we were in our own closed doors, but things like loss were happening at quite a scale that wasn't necessarily being discussed in the workplace. And as lead for Open Thanatology, that was one of the topics as a group we discussed and tried to make space for within the university, not to ignore that that's happening to people. And not just the loss of human lives, but also just the loss of understanding of how you live your life on a day-to-day basis, because things are happening, or a loss of expected futures that, you know, you had made plans that can no longer happen because of all these social restrictions. And Sharon had one day heard that another school in our faculty had managed to use some internal funding to self-publish a book of student essays, because the students were no longer able to do their final assignments. And so the lecturers turned that into a book. And we explored whether or not we could bid for some internal funding to do a collection around COVID and loss, recognizing again that within the university space, people didn't really have an outlet, and that this could be a potential outlet for those experiences and that energy that comes around that. And so we decided to co-edit a book on COVID and particularly around loss, and opened it up to anyone who was affiliated with the OU in any form. So it was staff, it was students, it was alumni, affiliated staff and honorary members, and anyone could write a really short narrative. So we asked for up to 2,000 words about their experience related to death, dying, loss, grief, bereavement, widely understood. And we managed to collate, I want to say, just over 30 different narratives around different themes. So some of them do talk about death and dying very explicitly. So there were deaths that people couldn't be present at. The ones that really stick with me are the ones where people felt they had very tricky decisions to make, whether it was to go be at the bedside of their parent, for example, or to go support the soon-to-be bereaved other parent because of the social restrictions meant that they could only do one, because if they were exposed to COVID, they'd have to then self-isolate and not necessarily attend to the people that were grieving whilst also having their own grief. So there's those types of examples. There's also examples of how the social isolation and the pulling away of daily routine brought up previous loss and grief for people, and how, you know, whether those were death related or mental health issues and that kind of brought up, and shifting of identities and that kind of thing. Then there was also several examples of living with grief in that time and not feeling able to grieve because of changed rituals and practices or not having people around them as they would expect. And then we have a few examples also of people who worked in health or social care settings and how that was really difficult for them, and also the exposure to death and grief on there, and then having to come back into a home space that didn't necessarily chime with that in the same way. And we have found that the writing of the book, or the editing of the book and people writing it, was quite eye-opening, because there was, you know, some colleagues wrote that, you know, we had weekly meetings with, but we didn't necessarily know that level of what was going on in their lives. So it opened up a bit of people's experiences in a way that we wouldn't have otherwise had exposure to. We also had several people who wrote for us said they found it was very therapeutic, or it was a nice way to memorialize someone who had died. And we also had a few people who wrote to us and didn't submit anything, but they found the prompt really useful for their own personal reflection. And then that was a theme that we found as we've talked about the book in different spaces has been really beneficial for people. So we've done different events, both within the university and externally, to sort of encourage that sort of holding space for people and recognizing that a lot had happened in that sort of particularly intense first 2 years of the pandemic that connected people's experiences with others in a way that perhaps maybe the news headlines doesn't quite do in the same way.
It's a beautiful book and one that's very emotionally affecting to read. And I should emphasize to people that although most of the contributors were associated with the Open University, it's readily available. You can get it on Amazon and from all good booksellers. So I would highly recommend it.
And I'll just add, it's free on a lot of ebook platforms, and the PDF version's free on our university website as well.
Thanks, Erica. So you mentioned that you lead the Open Thanatology Group at the Open University. I know you had a competition for that name, and it's not a word that people outside the field be familiar with. So maybe you could say a bit about the title, but also just be interested to know about the kinds of activities that the group engage in. And how does its work connect not just to research, but also to public education around death and dying?
Yeah, thanks. So the OU has a long-standing history of doing research in the field of death, dying, and bereavement for over 2 decades. And when I joined the OU, there was maybe a handful of us doing that type of work, but it was all kind of like in a silo element. Everyone did their own individual projects. There wasn't necessarily much collaboration. When I took over the lead of the group, in, I think it was 2020, yeah, I realized part of the issue with this lack of collaboration and the small numbers is that people didn't necessarily feel they always belonged to the narrow definition of only focusing on death, dying, and bereavement in health, which my work in end-of-life care, of course, fit very naturally in. But for other people, they felt a bit more at the margins, but also that the way the group had been run didn't necessarily facilitate interdisciplinary or professional collaboration. And so one of the things I did was then to figure out, well, how can we rename the group that allows people to feel more welcome or that their work might fit in it? So we held a public competition to help rename the group, which is always a fun thing. You never know what you're going to get. All sorts of different acronyms. And we settled on Open Thanatology after much debate within the group. And actually, we don't know who suggested that because it was an anonymous suggestion online. But the reason we went with that is because it had open, which both reflects the university in terms of Open University, but also in terms of our ethos, in terms of as a group, we want to be more open to different ideas, different disciplines, different people, different perspectives. And then thanatology, which is the word that I think I misspell on a weekly basis, and it's more popular in the States than it is here, but is generally understood as the study of things related to death. And so it can cover a huge range of things, and it's not about a specific context. It doesn't necessarily mean we're only looking about loss in terms of grief or bereavement, which often, you know, people assume to be around people. So it was a way of allowing us to be much broader in our understanding of the death-related topics that could be within the group. And as part of that, actually, the group numbers really expanded, which has been quite nice. And we do a lot of activities, both internally in the university and externally facing. And some of the key activities we do is fostering research projects and building teams of people around different projects, both for things that are important to the university, but also for external collaborators. So we have projects supporting different organizations to help them make sense of what they do. And then the other element that we do is a lot around education, whether it's public education through creating resources on OpenLearn, so the Open University's platform for free learning. So we have lots of interactive short videos, articles, and short courses. And then also where possible, we support OU and BBC co-productions on death-related topics. And again, from quite a broad range of perspectives and not just focused on healthcare. And then one of the exciting things about the OU is our curriculum is research informed. So also the research findings or key insights from different projects led by the group can feed back into our modules. And we have a flagship module in death, dying, and bereavement at the OU called K220 Death, Dying, and Bereavement. And so my own research and other people's research all feeds into there in different ways. And it's quite exciting because a lot of the people that teach on that module are also part of Open Thanatology. So it's the research is reflected not just in the actual module material, but also in terms of the conversations they're having with students when new things come out.
That's great. And I'll provide a link in the episode details to Open Thanatology and to the Open Learn Hub and to the Death and Dying module. So finally, Erica, can I ask you what you're working on at the moment? What plans you've got for research and writing in the future?
Oh, it's always a great question. So I have lots of different things going on at the moment. Some of the stuff is, like I said, in Open Thanatology, helping support teams, working on different projects, particularly around service evaluation or policy analysis, including end-of-life care and bereavement policy. I'm quite excited that on the horizon, or what I have coming at the moment, is some ethnographic work, specifically looking at end-of-life care. There's a few of those projects that I have. One of them, which should be starting later this calendar year, is specifically around palliative and end-of-life care provision for people with learning disabilities and how we might use ethnographic methods and co-research methods to understand that better, with the idea that we might then have some indication of how it could be done even better in the future. And also mentoring people who are new to ethnographic methods in a variety of projects, including how we might use ethnographic methods to understand cultural humility and cultural safety in palliative and end-of-life care.
It's very interesting that work around learning disability obviously intersects with another research strength of our school at the Open University. It just remains for me to say a very warm thank you, Erica, for being a guest on the podcast today. I certainly feel I know your work a good deal better now and have a much better appreciation of its importance than I did before. So thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
So that's all we have time for on this episode of Careful Thinking. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope you'll subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to comment or provide feedback on this or any other episode, or if you want to suggest a guest or a topic for a future episode, you can email me at carefulthinkingpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on my Substack, which you can find at carefulthinking.substack.com. And all of these details are on the podcast website. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.